David Marotta joins us each and every month, and of course you read him in the business section of the daily newspaper every Monday, and he has excellent and terrific columns in there, lots of information. I encourage you to read it weekly, but we're also privileged to have him here in the studio with us once a month to discuss important issues regarding finance and the economy, and we're also pleased today to have a return visit from George Marotta, David's father, who is here visiting from California. And I love it that he's here visiting. He's on vacation, but he's spending some time with us here on The Shilling Show. So, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you.
Enjoying the hot weather here on the East Coast.
Well, I'm glad somebody is. I wish I could trade with you for a little while. In any event, we have this financial reform pitfalls we want to talk about regarding the Dodd-Frank financial regulation bill. And what precipitated this? I guess I'd like to first, you know, find out why it is we have this bill. So in your opinion, what was it that led us here?
Well, I think the best answer is probably that Congress can't let any crisis go without taking the opportunity to increase government power and government regulation. And so the Dodd-Frank bill is a follow-on of the 2008 financial crisis meltdown. Not that the two necessarily have anything to do with one another, other than they both use the word finance. And this purports to solve all of the problems in 2008, except it doesn't really address any of them.
George, your take on how we got to this place.
The Federal Reserve kept interest rates too low. We wanted to put everybody in the house, home ownership, the ownership society. Mm. And that was a mistake because they were allowed to go buy houses without down payments, and they couldn't afford to keep the payments up when the value of their houses went down. This bill does nothing to solve that problem.
Let me ask you about that, because you know it was touted for a while that, you know, homeownership was the road to independent wealth building and people needed to. But I mean, throughout the course of private property ownership and home ownership in this country, I mean, not everybody. There was a place for people to rent always, and not everybody was cut out to be a homeowner. So why? What was the agenda behind pushing this? I mean, were there good intentions behind it?
I think so. Homeownership means that you have a stake in society, and mm-hmm. you'll be a better citizen. But you know, this crisis is worldwide. It's not just U.S. This over ownership of homes took place in Europe and other countries, where the world boom allowed us to go on credit,
mm-hmm.
and too much credit resulted in finally a collapse of the boom, and so all countries are having the same problem that we're having: Great Britain, France, where too many people got into homes who couldn't afford to keep their ownership up.
David?
Yeah, it used to be that owning a home was a sign that you were wealthy because you had to put a 20 or 30% down payment down mm-hmm. on a house. And that made home loans one of the most secure loans that banks could do.
Because that's a lot of money.
Yeah, because that's a lot of money. And usually home prices, when they do correct, don't correct by 20 or 30%. So in that transaction, Congress said, well, gosh, if home loans are the most secure loans that banks can make, why don't we just give everybody a home loan? And then suddenly they threw all the lending practices out that made them secure loans and made something which has been stable historically as far as we can tell going back, suddenly one of the most dangerous, toxic assets that you can have is a home loan on a house that's underwater because they didn't put a down payment down. It's an example of the congressional hubris of thinking that because they know something, they can therefore micromanage an economy that is very complex with lots of moving parts and unintended consequences.
You know, I hearken back to something that George said a few minutes ago that I thought was very astute. And you said, you know, this home ownership was good because it was providing a stake in society. And tying it into what David said, people were having no stake in their own loans. I mean, when I was, you know, and I've been involved in real estate and been licensed realtor since the mid-1980s. And so I've seen this boom and bust cycle in California and now also across the nation. But I mean, people had to put down, like you said, 20%. And if people could put down 3% or 1% or what was most preposterous of all, zero down, I mean, what inclination they have to stay with the property if anything got rough.
And government is continuing this problem by allowing people to put only 3% down. And Dave said it might even be as low as 1.5%.
Yeah, I heard there was some debate between 1.5% and 3% of what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were gonna continue writing loans at. And I forget which one finally won. But
this is preposterous on face value. To look at all the trouble we've had, we know why it is. People left because they had no stake. And now we're giving people an opportunity to buy a home again with no stake.
Yep.
Why is this?
It doesn't make any sense. And I think it's when you try to use the economics to do social engineering, mm-hmm. That's almost always a bad idea. Economics can write itself so long as there's a free market, so long as you allow banks to lend at the practices that they want to lend at. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac always were allowed to lend with more favorable conditions than any bank could lend, and as a result, I think almost every loan right now is housed at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they've had to institutionalize it rather than let it go under. And most Republicans and most libertarians would say simply disbanding Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is a step in the right direction, because then you put it back in a free market, and the free market, while it can make mistakes, has built-in corrections that will right itself. And that's the most amazing thing about the Dodd-Frank bill, is that it leaves untouched the question of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and just punts that to later, to say, oh, we'll deal with that later, because we know that's not really the problem. The problem is really something else. And so they've put all this government power in place and not undone the government power that caused it in the first place.
We've got about a minute before the break, and I just want to ask you, because you talk about the disbanding of Fannie and Freddie, is that practical? Could that practically be done? And if so, what would that look like?
Yeah, I think you simply throw the practice of lending for home mortgages back onto the banks, who have mm-hmm. a vested interest in writing the rules and regulations such that only people who can afford to pay the mortgage payments are the ones that they're going to loan to.
And are there liabilities there that would have to be paid for if we disbanded these organizations?
I think you could simply say they can't write any new loans, they can't accept any new loans, and you could unwind it gradually.
And just phase them out.
Yeah, just gradually phase them out.
George, what do you think about that?
I think that could be done, and I think it should be done, because this bill does not deal with the problem of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac at all.
What are we talking about money-wise? Billions, trillions of dollars here in these organizations?
I think Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae I remember the figure, like $150 billion that they've been subsidized so far.
So far, and that hasn't gotten them out of all their problems. There's probably more coming down the line, would we imagine?
And they're still guaranteeing these loans, new loans that are coming out. So they should be phasing that out and getting it over into the private sector.
Yeah, I mean, the first step is always to stop the bleeding.
Yeah, that's right. First, do no harm, as they say.
That's right.
All righty. We're talking with George Marotta and David Marotta. Today we're talking about the financial reform pitfalls. Of course, the boy congressman supported this bill, and we are not pleased with his vote there. But we wanted to expose what the problems were. And we'll have much more of the Marottas when the Shilling Show returns right after this. I recall when I was small, how I spent my days alone. And it is the Shilling Show. Thanks so much for joining us. Weekdays from noon to 2. We appreciate your presence here, and we are continuing on with David Marotta and his father, George, who's here visiting us once again for this week. He's here from California. Both of them from Marotta Wealth Management, online at emarotta.com. You can visit them there. We're talking about pitfalls of the financial reform bill, also known as the Dodd-Frank bill. And so, David, you told me that you'd read, a good portion of this, maybe more than our congressman read or many of the others who voted in favor of it. 2,300 and some pages of what?
Yeah, it's interesting. The bill is incredibly long. I don't fault the congressman for not having read it. I could have voted against it without having read
it. Right.
but it's mostly just a letter to federal agencies to say, make sure that nothing bad happens in the future. make sure that there's nothing evil going on, make sure we don't have another financial meltdown. It doesn't tell them how to do that, but it makes clear who are the people who will be held accountable in the federal agencies if something bad happens. And then in the bill, they're given a wide latitude of new and unchecked powers to do whatever it might take to make sure that bad things don't happen. Unfortunately, now we have to fear their exercise of their new and unchecked powers. And a great quote from someone I was talking to, I'd rather risk Wall Street predators than government protectors.
Well, absolutely. But I mean, this is almost preposterous to think that we are ceding all of this power to bureaucrats, 2,300 pages and very little substance, just basically saying, okay, here's an agency, and they're going to make the rules themselves. I mean, that sounds almost contra-constitutional.
Yeah, it establishes, I think, 355 potential new agency rules that can be set. It mandates funding 47 studies. It requires, by law, 74 different reports. The good news is it will probably create more jobs than any of the bailout efforts. Unfortunately, all of those new hires will be lawyers, lobbyists. It's a lobbyist dream. There's so many new rules that can be set, and all of the big financial companies will game the system for their own good, and all of the politicians will collect lobbyist money and contribution money to make sure that they get set a certain way. So it's really a huge power in the federal government that will be used, I'm sure, in selfish and self-centered ways.
977-1070 is the phone number here on The Shilling Show. We have a line open for you at 977-1070. If you have questions or comments for our guests, George Murata and David Murata, who join us for this hour. And Gary is on the line. Gary, thanks so much for calling. You're on with the Muratas.
Thanks very much. Really enjoy listening to them when they're on every month. It's great, great help. I had a couple questions. One, I wondered if they would talk about what role they think federal government does have in finances, if any. You know, what things do they do right? What things should they do? And the other question is, I wonder what they think of the Dave Ramsey philosophy of finance, where basically he doesn't want people to incur any debt except for their mortgage. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Yeah, Gary, thanks very much. Excellent questions.
Yeah, let me take the second one first. I love Dave Ramsey. He's a great the Dave Ramsey Financial Peace program to help people get out of debt and stay out of debt is one of the few systems I've actually seen work. We run a version of it at our church twice a year, and the reason why it works is because getting out of debt is not primarily financially running the numbers. Getting out of debt is having a support group and changing your thinking about spending and money. And that's why Dave Ramsey says no debt. Dave Ramsey says no debt because you have to change your thinking. And if you told somebody who's in debt that there's such a thing as good debt, they'd max out whatever you told them good debt was, and they'd be in a worse shape than anything else.
Right.
If you're more sophisticated and you're not in credit card debt and you're living well below your means, there is such a thing as good debt. I think borrowing student loans to go to school is actually a good idea. I think home ownership, if used properly with a good down payment, I think that's a good idea too. So there's a couple of cases where you can have good debt, and it's but Dave Ramsey is right. If you're in credit card trouble, getting out of debt entirely is a good first step.
All righty, and then the other question, and I'm going to throw this one to George. You know, what is it that the government does right, and is there an appropriate place for government regulation on the financial industry?
I think the agencies of finance had all the power to stop what happened in the past. And to think that this new legislation was going to be able to predict future problems, the legislation ends too big to fail, but they are also propping up AIG and General Motors and whatnot. This bill creates a $50 billion fund that is going to help us in the future. If it looks as if a big financial organization is going to go down, it helps them to go down gradually. So will this work? I don't know, but it's going to cost a lot because that $50 billion will have to be raised by banks and financial institutions, and it'll come out of the consumer's pocket one way or the other. So it's I think the problem is that we got too deeply into debt, and now the government is getting into debt more to try to solve the problem in a Keynesian way, to stimulate the economy. So someday we're going to have to stop this adding to public debt, and we're going to have to start deleveraging. And that's going to be very, very difficult for us to do. It's going to take the cooperation of both political parties, which doesn't look possible right now, but maybe things have to get really much worse before Congress will do something about it.
Well, it's certainly my concern is that this is driving people to be greater and greater dependence on government, and then government's going to have to come in and do something about it, and then everyone will say, oh, thank you, government, and then, you know, in the meantime, we have given away all of our rights and many of our freedoms because the government saved us.
You know, the biggest thing that I think the federal government should be doing is really eliminating the fraud that goes on in the financial industry. They investigated Bernie Madoff twice. They were told exactly why it must be a Ponzi scheme. They knew they should have known why his returns were fraudulent. And I read the book No One Would Listen by by Markovlich, who tried to blow the whistle on him several times. And what's interesting is they had a list of transactions that Bernie Madoff said he had done. They were going to go and check it against a list of transactions. They decided it would be too difficult to match the transactions, so they never even asked for the list they should have asked for. It would have been easy because they would have gotten a blank slip of paper. There were no transactions made by him. So investigating fraud requires somebody first who understands the financial services, and instead the SEC is filled with lawyers. So all you get is, from regulation, all you get is paperwork. Your paperwork is in order. And paperwork being in order is something that it doesn't really help the consumer against fraud, because the first thing you forge is your paperwork.
Yes.
So the government did have a role to play in margin requirements, in transparency, in eliminating force and fraud, in providing the rules by which financial institutions would be governed. And then we have a court system to help enforce those. We don't need agencies to help enforce those. Our court systems actually work very well. So really, if they had had more financial people and less lawyers, that was the result of the book No One Would Listen. Is the first thing you'd have to do is to fire all the lawyers and hire financial people. And unfortunately, this bill, the Dodd-Frank bill, moves in the opposite direction. It's moving toward greater numbers of lawyers and fewer numbers of people who actually know what they're doing in the financial world.
There's not only trouble on the horizon, we're knee-deep in it right now. 977-1070 is the phone number. And Chris, hold it. We'll get to you in just a minute. And let's say hello to Gary, another Gary who's been waiting for us very patiently. Gary, thanks for calling. You're on with George and David Murata.
Thanks, Rob, and thanks, George and Dave, for being on the show. George and David, can you walk me through what happens when there's a municipal bond default? Does a municipal bondholder, does that person go first in line when that municipality tries to repay its obligations? Thank you.
Yeah, Gary, thanks very much.
In California, we have Vallejo, which is undergoing really difficult financial times. They have had to let go like half of the police department, half of the fire department. They have not yet defaulted on the bonds. But I think what would happen in that case if I think the state might come into play on that. I'm not sure how much insurance they have to do that, because the state of California, like the state of New York, is in deep financial problem. But there could be default on municipal bonds, and unfortunately, they're very attractive right now because tax rates are going to go up, and everybody's looking at municipal bonds. But we recommend that you not get into municipal bonds unless they are what rating, Dave?
Well, yeah, and Gary, that the short answer, unfortunately, for your question is it depends, because all muni bonds are not equal. Some muni bonds are backed by revenue, and some muni bonds have insurance that's associated with them, and some muni bonds are not backed by anything and could go into default, and you could receive pennies on the dollar. I think I remember reading that the typical muni bond default gets paid about 88 cents on the dollar, which isn't bad. But the worst case is when you buy a muni bond that has a high rating and then it goes to a low rating, that muni bond actually goes down in value. Now, if you hold it to maturity and you own the individual bond, you will probably get paid back. It probably won't go into default. But if you own a bond fund, then the bond fund is evaluated on a daily basis, and a downturn in their credit rating actually hurts the bond fund itself. It will go down in value. And because of the complexities of muni bonds and because municipalities are really getting hit, that's the reason to steer clear of muni bonds. There may be a place for them if you're in the highest tax bracket. You make over $250,000. You've had the bullseye painted on your forehead. But in that case, I would get individual muni bonds, and I would look at all the different factors associated with them, primarily to answer Gary's question, and that is, when do you get paid back if the bond goes into default? And if it's backed by a revenue stream, then it's a little bit better than if it's backed by other things.
All righty, 977-1070 is the phone number. We have one line open for you right now, and let's say hello to Chris. And Chris, thanks so much for calling The Shilling Show. You're on with the Marottas.
Thanks for taking my call, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's good to hear from you.
Hello, Mr. Marottas.
Hello.
Hi, I'm a person of limited character, and I wanted to speak a little bit about character and see what you all had to say about it. I heard an economist the other over the weekend from the Midwest. He's actually from India, and he projected in 2005 this crash. And I can't remember the gentleman's name. He also said that the backbone of this crash was people getting into housing that had no business getting into housing financially.
True.
And the policies that were put forth, I guess, by the Democrats to try to promote that.
Both parties.
Both parties.
Yes.
Okay, well, my limited sense of character, which I've only gained in the past 10 years, I guess says to me, why are not people speaking more about this? Why is there some sort of debate about why this crash happened if it's pretty evident that this was one of the main causes? And if so, why are we not holding the feet to the fire of these people that made this policy a choice, I think, to try to help people, but in the bottom line, it ended up just devastating us. And why is this sort of character not brought out to the forefront in a major way? I mean, I know you don't want to place blame too much, but don't we have to learn from our mistakes? I mean, isn't that part of character?
Yeah.
And just one more thing. My sense of character, which is very limited, is how I behave when no one's looking, how I regulate my behavior when no one's looking. And if I regulate it well, maybe I have some good character. If I don't, then maybe my character isn't that good. And I wanted to just get your thoughts on it, and thank you for your time.
I like what you're saying, because I think it comes down to the fact that we've got to do a better job in our education, the schools and the parents, to educate our children on financial matters. And this is going to take a long time because we are a consuming society.
Mm-hmm.
We spend 70% of our economy is consumer spending.
Mm-hmm.
Dave, give the figures that we just looked up on how many mortgages are underwater, and the overall picture is going to be a lot of deleveraging taking place, a lot of people reducing their debt and saving in the future.
Yeah, about 70% of homes currently have a mortgage. That's about 44.4 million home mortgages. Of those that have a mortgage, I read that 21.5% are underwater.
God.
And that means that they owe more on their house than it's worth, probably from not putting a sufficient down payment down, or maybe a down payment and then a tremendous downturn in the economy.
See, 1 in 5, and a lot of those people are continuing their monthly payments. And they would, financially, they might be better off to declare bankruptcy, but which you can do, and walk away from your home. But I think we ought to really be helping those people who are underwater to try to continue to make their payments, and the banks and the government and society in general.
Yeah, unfortunately, about half that number is underwater and in trouble. So of the 21%, maybe 10%. Are underwater and in trouble, and probably shouldn't have a mortgage in the first place, And for them, walking away from it might be the right choice, and continuing to subsidize them might be the wrong choice. So it gets really complex when you, as you've said, Chris, it gets really complex when people have gotten themselves into a mess, and now we feel sorry for them, and we're trying to figure out how to help them get out. What's interesting in this country is that the bankruptcy laws, I think, are actually underutilized. Bankruptcy is a good choice for someone who's gotten in over their head, rather than working for the next 10 years for no equity just to pay off their loan.
But I'm thinking of the matter of character of those people who could walk away, but they can make the monthly payment, and they're thinking, well, maybe the value of the houses will come back up again, and they continue those monthly payments. They're helping our society by not walking away from their homes.
Yeah. But what about the character of the politicians that put these people in that untenable position of not being able to afford a home? That's kind of what I was talking about.
And Chris, you're exactly right. Two of the character problems we have are named Dodd and Frank.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Of all of the contributions, I think I looked up. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac gave $4.8 million to various members of Congress to help their campaigns. The number one contributor who received the most amount of money was Dodd. He got $167,400, and I think repaying that would be an act of character on his part. Mm-hmm. Frank only got $42,350, but he was certainly in the top 20 Democrats to be receiving money. If you run down the list, you know, it's Dodd, it's Obama, it's Hillary Clinton, it's Pelosi, it's Reid. They're all on the list of being major contributors. And now that we have so many more rules to write, you know that all of those agencies that are writing all of those rules will also be agencies that, you know, have a political stake. And there'll be corporations and others who are giving massive amounts of money to help make sure the rules are written right. My rule is that anytime you give government power, that power will have a corrupting influence. And if you want to eliminate government corruption rather than increase government power, which is Nancy Pelosi's solution to the problem, you actually have to decrease government power. You have to take power away because no one worries about a government which is simply trying to run a legislature that's keeping force and fraud and court systems and those simple rules in place.
And Chris, thank you so much for the call. And one thing I want to get to here is, George, something you brought up and deals with education. And I don't see anything getting better except maybe out of the homeschool and the private school community. But as far as government schools go, I don't think we're being better educated regarding finances and economics. And I don't think we're being better educated in understanding the foundational principles of the country. So that's two strikes. How are we actually going to address this? Because it doesn't look like it's going to happen institutionally through government schools.
This is the first crisis that this younger generation is facing. Getting out of school and not having a job. And I think that will be the wake-up call. That will be the on-the-street kind of education that they didn't get when they were in college on assuming too much debt. What did you say, Dave, about getting a credit card for college students? You would prevent them from getting a credit card when they're still in college?
I mean, credit card debt in college, the average college student, I think, ends up with a credit card with a few thousand dollars on it by the time they graduate, which is a terrible lesson to learn because it starts that negative income of all of the debt.
You know, there are responsible among us. I did get a credit card when I was in college, but ever since then, I have never carried a monthly balance, and that's been many, many years ago. So there are a few people, and I have to give credit to my own parents who instructed me properly in managing money, but I have a lot of friends who got in trouble right off the bat. Bob is on the line, and we've got just a minute or so left. Bob, thanks for calling the Shilling Show.
Hi.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Yes, I have a question for Mr. Murata.
Yes,
David.
Go.
You just listed a lot of Democrats who have received money.
Or,
He's breaking up.
Yeah, I think we lost
the
him.
Question might be, how about Republicans?
Yeah, if you look at the list, the Republicans are slightly less guilty than the Democrats. I think it was something like 43% Republicans.
I'm not interested in guilt. Who are the Republicans?
Yeah.
Oh,
gosh. You seem to know the list of Democrats. Who are the Republicans?
That's a great question. They don't show up at the very top of the list, which I was running down. They show up further on down.
I didn't ask you that. I said, who are the Republicans that are on the list?
Yeah, I would say basically every Republican who's a current incumbent and every Democrat who's a current incumbent is on the list.
I would say the way you're responding is that you don't know.
No, I don't. I don't know the
okay.
The top. But most of them are the Senate.
Point well made. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's true that the Democrats are slightly more culpable in this. They were defending Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and their supporters in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were rewarding that. I think it's 57% of the donations were given to Democrats and 43% Republicans.
And we should look at the name on the bill, by the way. I don't see a Republican's name on the bill, although I'm sure Republicans did vote for it, right? Or did they not?
Three Republicans crossed over to support the Dodd-Frank bill.
Yeah.
Yep.
Dodd-Frank. Those, I think, are Democrats.
Both Democrats, yeah.
Right. Okay. Point taken. Bob, thank you very much for the call. George Murata, we hope you'll come again next month and every month to visit us from California. We can't pay your airfare, but we'll give you a nice air-conditioned room.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Thank you so much. And David Murata, thank you, of course, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Visit him online at emurata.com. The Shilling Show will return with Ken Boyd right after the news.